Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hello everyone, it's Jesse Green here. Welcome back to SavvyDentist.com and to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. It is terrific to have your company for another episode of our show. Now, if you've ever thought that running a dental practice can be challenging at times, well, frankly, you're absolutely right. It can be very challenging on occasion. But how about running 8 practices all at once? Well, that's exactly what my guest today does. And Dr. Dylan Heim is a specialist maxillofacial surgeon here in Canberra. And along with his business partner, he also operates the TMJ clinics around the country. Now, Dylan and I had a really wide-ranging conversation. We started talking about what got him into dentistry and into MaxFax in the first place, and some really good lessons there about decision-making and how to make decisions that are effective over the long haul. But what I really took away from this conversation, well, lots of things I took away, but one of the main things I took away was just how considered Dylan is in his approach to life and indeed business as well. And that considered approach, I guess, is really underpinned by a strong sense of values and principles. And one of those principles that Dylan holds very dear is, above all else, the work must be good. Now, we all know that as healthcare providers, we want to do great work that we're proud of. And what Dylan shares is his long-term approach to building success in practice based on this value of doing great dentistry or great work. And he's also a really, really astute businessman, because what he talks about is how he builds teams, and his businesses operate remotely from his headquarters, and he's been able to instill great culture remotely. So if you've ever wanted to own more than one practice, or even if you want to run your one practice much better, there's so much value in what Dylan shares around culture, building people, how to make decisions, how to cope with setbacks, how to work within compressed timeframes if you've come up with a medical situation like he did, which shortened his or potentially shortens his career, and how to have a plan A, a plan B, a plan C, and a plan D. So much value in this conversation that is going to be incredibly useful to everyone in business. Now, again, I want to say that Dylan is perhaps one of the nicest people you'll ever meet. He's really kind, he's really generous, and he shares so openly in this podcast, and he really just lays out all the things that have helped him succeed in business and indeed life. This is a rich conversation full of pearls of wisdom that I know you're going to want to write down, and I know you're going to not just want to write them down, but perhaps reflect on those insights and how to apply them in your own life as well. So without any further ado, here's Dr. Dylan Heim, and I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I enjoyed recording it with him. Dylan, thank you so much for taking the time to come and join us on the podcast. It's great to have you here, mate, a fellow Canberran. Welcome.
Thanks, Jesse. It's a delight to be here, and thanks very much for the invitation.
Mate, I've been looking forward to this conversation for a long time, and obviously in Canberra, you're incredibly well-known, incredibly well-respected, and what I'm really interested to talk to you about today is a bit about your journey and a lot about your business skills as well, because you've always enjoyed business, and obviously this is a business podcast, which is, when we speak to specialists, it's not often an interest that they have. So I'm curious about your upbringing and your background, mate. How did you find your way into dentistry in the first place?
Oh, I'm a very accidental dentist. Okay. I was always going to be an aeronautical engineer, and then I went and did work experience, and every engineer I spoke to said, don't do it, which I was shocked and surprised at. And then I thought maybe about joining the Air Force and being a pilot. But in the end, I got a great mark at school, and I thought I probably wasn't responsible enough to be a doctor. I liked working with my hands, so I thought dentistry was probably a good mix of physical work and business. So that sort of struck a chord for me. And I think I put my preferences in at about 4:45 on the Friday afternoon before you had to choose. And my family were so shocked.
Oh, really? What did they have you pegged for?
Oh, they all just thought I'd have to do engineering and that would be the end of it. So, yes, so it was a big shock for everyone when I told them what I'd decided to do.
Okay, cool. Was dentistry all you hoped it would be after all that? You know, 4:45 on the Friday, it sounds a little bit like a wing and a prayer. Maybe it wasn't, but were you happy with that decision in the end?
I'm very happy now. I count myself as an exceptionally lucky person to have the job and the career that I've had. I really, you know, can't impress upon people how lucky I feel. You know, not every day, but you know, yeah. in general.
Yeah.
I must say the first few years of dental school were brutal for me. That was not my natural place. So I found it to be very, very academic and very little practical element to it. And then third year, I kind of started to see the light of a bit of practicality in what we were doing. And then fourth year, we started to do exoclinic and minor oral surgery, and it was just light bulbs flashing everywhere for me. And there was, I don't think I've done more than one root canal in my life, but I've taken out about 80,000 teeth. So, you know, there was clearly a focus and an area of joy for me. And I've always just followed that golden seam of, you know, the things that I enjoyed and thought that I could do and do well, I've done and invested more time and effort into.
So, you know, as you said, that the latter years of dental school became more hands-on, more practical. Obviously, you know, even with that engineering interest, you probably had that sense of tinkering and fixing things and doing all those sorts of hand-eye coordination sort of things. Max Facts, you know, was that something that you thought about early in your dental degree, or was it when you hit that, you know, minor oral surgery and exodontia clinic that you kind of went, I really like this, I could spend my whole day doing this? Was it that early or was it a bit later?
It was probably a bit later. About halfway through third year, we started to meet surgeons and meet this concept. I didn't really know that it existed. I didn't know that it was a thing. And then in fourth year, we had a lovely tutor called Malcolm Bourne, and he just tapped me on the shoulder one day and he said, you're quite good at this, you should think about doing it. And that was probably the only piece of positive feedback I got in the 5 years, so I followed it.
Yeah. You know? Dental school in the 80s and 90s was a different experience than it is today. I'm just going to say that out loud.
Oh, they treated you mean to keep you keen, didn't they?
Oh, jeez, mate.
It was brutal.
It was brutal. You didn't want to be too sensitive at the time because it could absolutely cripple you.
No, I caught up with some friends from dental school just a couple of weeks ago and everyone had the same experience. And, I mean, it created very thick-skinned, capable people. But unfortunately, along the way, there was people who had to leave because they couldn't. They just didn't fit that learning style. And so I'm very pleased that these days it's a bit more inclusive for people and that we get a broader spectrum of the community into practicing dentistry. Yeah,
and it really hones that perfectionistic tendency that we probably all have anyway. And, you know, I remember feeling at dental school that it was either perfect or wrong. There was a very binary kind of...
You were lucky to get perfect, Jesse.
Perfect, but it was like, I usually got wrong, mate, but it was never perfect. It was like, no.
I used to spend hours and hours in those dental labs fixing stuff that I should have just done properly in the first place.
Oh, mate. I know. All good fun. You graduate from university.
Yep.
You ended life as a general practitioner for a period of time, presumably. What was that like? And again, were you still then thinking, I'm going to go and specialise as a surgeon?
Yeah, well, I never really got to practice as a general. I mean, technically I practiced as a general dentist for a couple of years in the army, but it's not really like general dentistry. You know, half your time spent doing regimental duties and courses and things like that. So I'm sure you had the same experience in the Navy. I did some dentistry. It probably wasn't great general dentistry, but it was the best that I could do. And I started to just spend more and more time in theatres. We had a lovely man called Bruce Peter used to come to my base, you know, Bruce, yeah.
Hi, Bruce, yeah.
He taught me how to take out wisdom teeth. And again, I just kept following that seam and doing more and more of the things that I enjoyed and seemed to do well at. And so within a couple of years, I was back at Westmead Hospital as a Max Facts registrar.
Yeah. Okay. So tell us a little bit about life as a maxillofacial surgeon, because most people listening to this podcast are in general practice, or maybe they're in specialty practice, but generally they might be in endo or perio or something rather than Max Facts. So tell us a little bit about the day-to-day of Max Facts practice. Obviously you consult, you operate, but what are the challenges that come up with that particular business model? Obviously maxillofacial surgeons don't grow on trees, so how do you get leverage?
My days are pretty straightforward. I operate in the mornings and I consult in the afternoons.
Yeah.
I'm very lucky over the years I've managed to construct a timetable like that, and that suits me very, very well. In terms of the actual practice, I think, you know, the old three A's, able, available and affable.
We were talking yesterday and we're talking a bit about your life, and you're saying to me that most people graduate thinking they might have a 35-40 year career, but you didn't have that opportunity to plan 35, 40 years in your career, you're thinking maybe a shorter career, and that meant you had to kind of get up to speed and accelerate your learning, accelerate your progress. So can we just talk a little bit about what's sitting behind that?
Yeah. So when I was in medical school, I was in a cardiology tutorial and they needed a volunteer. None of the girls wanted to take their shirts off and I was the only guy in the tutorial, so it had to be me. Everyone listened to my chest and, you know, heard the two heart sounds, and that was great. And then the tutorial finished, and as I was walking out, the tutor grabbed me and he said, "How long have you had your heart murmur for?" And I said, "Oh, about 10 seconds now." And he said, "Yeah." He said, "I want you to go and see the cardiology professor." And I said, "Oh, yeah, no worries. I'll sort it out." And he goes, no, now." And so I went and saw him, and probably over the next 6 months, things kind of deteriorated and I ended up having my aortic valve and my pulmonary valve replaced when I was, I think I was about 27, 28, something like that, newly married and just sort of getting into the real nuts and bolts of building a career and finishing medical school. So that, it was quite shocking at the time because you go from being invincible to broken in a conversation, but then you very quickly kind of accept that life is limited and you, if you want to do things, you need to get on and do them. And so I think it probably just helped give me a sense of urgency about what I was doing and that I didn't have forever to get on with it. And that's sort of been part of the way that I've done things. If I want to do something, I just get on and do it and make the most of it. And I rarely say no to an opportunity just because I've always been cognizant that it might not come around again.
When you were thinking about your career and thinking, well, hang on, I've had this replacement of the aortic valve and the pulmonary valve and so on, and you're thinking, well, that could limit my career, what does that mean for you in terms of, I guess, skilling up? Were you pretty proactive and really kind of hitting the gas on the pedal to get that done?
I think I was aggressive, actually.
Well, I was going to use that word, but I thought maybe that was not the right word, but I'm glad you used it.
It's interesting. I think, you know, people who know me from when I was training and, you know, early in my career would probably have said that I was keen to get experience. You know, my wife and I, we moved to the UK to get more experience. Yeah. I tried to accelerate my training as much as I could. I probably wasn't very tolerant or understanding of situations where I didn't think I was getting great training. I wanted to move on and get somewhere where I could get better experience. You know, since then through to now in my career where I'm relatively relaxed and, you know, I've ticked all of the boxes of things that you want to do in surgery, I think now I can sit back and be a lot more relaxed about things. But certainly, you know, it just gave me a kick up the bum, really, to get on with things and to not waste opportunities or to waste time.
Yeah.
And I feel very lucky to have had that, because if I hadn't had that, I probably would have bumbled along and maybe done more or less, or, you know, maybe learned how to do head and neck cancer, or maybe travelled, or I might not have just felt the pressure or the drive to do that. So I'm not sure how much of that drive was just through normal maturation of going from being a 23-year-old guy with a brain that's made of jelly to being a 31-year-old father who's, you know, with financial responsibilities and things, or how much of that had to do with knowing that, you know, life is finite. But certainly something changed in those years to make me a little bit more focused about acquiring those skills.
You know, that is a sobering thought. I was talking to you yesterday and I was telling you that, you know, in my youth, I thought I wanted a surgical career and I broke my hand and the surgeon said to me, it's not going to happen for you, fella. And of course, you know, that again, it worked out fine for me and obviously things have worked out well for you too. But I wanted to ask you about the concept of plan Bs and thinking, okay, well, you know, I've got a family, I've got responsibilities, I've got all this other stuff going on. I may not be able to have a long-term surgical career. Therefore, I'm going to need to kind of have this plan B. Can we just talk a little bit about the thinking there and then we'll obviously get into what the plan B is?
I think having a plan B also means that you're open to other things. Mm. You're alert to other opportunities and other experiences. And, you know, when you're in the middle of doing surgical training or specialty training or building a practice or, you know, training the people around you, often you're so focused on what you're doing that things sort of float past you and you think, oh, yeah, I'll do that in a couple of years or, yeah, I'd really love to do that, but I've got too much on my plate at the moment. Whereas I think probably knowing that things can change and that you do need to have backup plans, I probably tried to expand the size of my plate and put more irons in the fire rather than defer things until it felt better or more comfortable. And that was actually a problem for me for a little bit, where I had so much going on that I probably wasn't doing a great job of any of it. I was, you know, hopefully I was competent, but, you know, in terms of some, not surgery, so, you know, when you do surgery, it's like when you're in the clinic with a patient, you're just totally focused on that. That never changes. But in terms of running your practice or, you know, being with your family and those sorts of things, you know, my wife instituted a really great rule a long time ago that whenever I say yes, I have to decide what it is I'm giving up, so that, you know, I maintain some semblance of balance. And so I've had periods where I've been really good at that, and I've had periods where I've been really poor at that. And, you know, at the moment I'm probably in a bit of a sweet spot in terms of balance and things, but other people might look and go, well, that's ridiculous.
I really love the fact that there's some real wisdom in that, you know, and, you know, Meg's come up with a real pearler there, which is, you know, if you say yes to this, what are you going to say no to, or what are you going to give up? And I think that's a really important key there.
It's important to note she's much smarter than me. So,
like all our wives are, mate. That's
yes, yes.
You know, I absolutely say that I've married up. But what I wanted to ask you about is, you know, when you had all these irons in the fire and you're juggling and all those, because I think people can relate to that as well. There'll be a lot of people listening just going, well, I feel that. How did you work your way through from that sense of juggling lots of things, feeling like you're perhaps not doing everything as well as you could? Obviously, the surgery was still really great because you're focused in that space, but outside of that arena, when where you were juggling these other balls, how did you manage to go from that sense of doing too much to getting a bit more balance? What was that journey like?
Well, some of it was just through not doing a great job and being embarrassed and thinking, well, how can I avoid this in the future? Or so that's a really bitter way to learn it. I think, as you were saying before, dentistry tends to breed people who want perfection and who have a very high standard for whatever they're doing. And so if you commit to contribute to the college or a volunteer organisation or whatever it is, you want to do it at the standard that you're happy with and proud of. And so I found that if I wasn't getting there, or I didn't think I was going to get there, then that made it easier for me to pull back and say, well, hang on, there's probably someone who can do this for you better than what I can. And so
you withdrew from some of those things is what I'm picking up there?
Well, I kind of did. Okay. I kind of did. I still wear a lot of hats.
Yeah, okay.
But the other thing I learned to do is to be very efficient. You know, it's a well-known phenomenon within our family that the work that we do, we tend to do once, and it's of a standard that is acceptable for whatever it is we're doing. So, you know, I like to compartmentalize things. I'll think about things for a certain period of time and then I just won't think about them. I don't tend to ruminate on things very much. And then if I sit down, like I sat down to write something for the college today, I've thought about that for an hour or two over the morning while I've been doing other things at the gym or those sorts of things, so that when I sit down to write it, it's already pretty straight in my head. And really the writing process is more about grammar and punctuation and layout. It's not about content. So I think I over time have become fairly efficient at those sorts of things, and that allows you to sort of grow the size of the plate or the fire that you're putting your irons into.
Efficiency, I think, is a really good skill to master. I would say that I am sometimes efficient and sometimes not, inconsistently efficient.
Yep.
Were you always that way? Because you said it's well known in our family that I'm pretty efficient. Is that something you've had from, you know, when you're a little tacker, or is it something, a skill you've had to learn and develop and grow?
I think I had a tendency towards it when I was young, but yeah, I've definitely refined it. And some of the things that have really helped me with that have been letting go a little bit, letting go of that perfection thing. One of my favourite sayings in surgery is the enemy of good is better. So you get something good, you move a fracture back to a great place, or, you know, you put something in it's a pretty good spot, and you look at it and you think, oh, I could do better than that. And then you undo it and you start again. But what you do is you open yourself up to all of the problems and complications a second time around. So you double your chance of having a problem.
Yeah.
When you do things in business, in life, in practice, if you've got it to a standard where it's good and it's probably as good as what someone else might give you if you'd paid for it or done whatever, stop. Just be happy. Stop. So that's okay. That's good. And if it's right for today, it's right for today. If it's not right for tomorrow, well, you can spend more time on it. But don't overthink things.
So we're getting into that law of diminishing returns.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. I really want to highlight that because I think there's a piece that you said, you spoke about it in the surgical context of, you know, reducing the fracture. But can you give me some examples of how you've applied that to your practice and business life? Because again, this is a business podcast, so I just want to try and make this as practical as possible for the listener.
Oh, look, hire early and fire early. Like if you find someone and you like them, hire them. And if they don't work out or they don't look like they're working out, just agree that that's probably not going to be the best fit. It's kinder for them and it's kinder for you.
Yeah.
Make your decisions, own them and stick with them. So, you know, if you make a decision and, you know, for instance, if you, I don't know, if you buy a microscope, if you want to do endo or whatever, and you can't decide whether to get the Leica or the Zeiss or whatever it is, please accept I don't know what I'm talking about with these microscopes. But
it's all right. Me neither, mate. You're right.
Okay, good. So you choose the Leica and you get it installed and you find out that, yeah, look, it's really good for everything except for the lower central where you think the Zeiss might have been better. Don't worry. You made the best decision with the information you had on the day and you went for it. And so surgery has helped me with that because surgery, there's no do-overs.
Yeah.
You do it. You sew the patient up, you send them out, and you get what you get. So you have to do it to a level of competence and success, but there's very little increased return for undoing it and doing it again. So, you know, those are the sorts of things that really help you become efficient.
I think, just to paraphrase what you said there for a second, you spoke about deciding and committing. So, you know, decide which microscope, commit and make the best of it, right? Rather than ruminating as you say, oh, I could have got this or I could have got that. Maybe I'll go back and change it and all the rest of it. Just and then get good at how to use that microscope to continue that metaphor.
Absolutely.
Like how do I get the best out of this microscope now? And then I'm going to work with it until it doesn't work and I'm just going to commit to that path and not look left, not look right. Is that kind of basically it?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, not to the point of self-detriment or any of those sorts of things, but you know, within reason. And the reality is, I think probably the other thing I understand is absolutely nothing is perfect. Once you learn more and more about whatever decision you made, you'll find more and more faults or more and more options or whatever it was that you could have done.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you accept that there's going to be an element of self-doubt with every decision, then it makes it easier to make a decision and get on with it because you know that 3 months later, you're going to go, geez, I wonder if I did the right thing, no matter which microscope you chose, no matter what decision you made. So once you can be comfortable with that kind of outcome, then you're okay to make your decisions and just live with them.
Yeah. It's really interesting. I was reading a book a little while ago by a lady called Annie Duke, and she was talking about evaluating decisions after the fact. And she's a professional gambler and she's a social researcher as well, so poker player.
Yep.
And so probability is what she was talking about. And one of the things she spoke about, and I think this ties into what you're discussing here as well, is she was talking about this particular football game. And I'm not an American football aficionado in any sense, but this particular coach called a particular play. It was, you know, close to the end of the game for the championship or whatever it was, and it went badly.
Yeah.
And the coach was pilloried because it went badly. You know, could have done this, could have done that. But she went back through and analysed all the video footage and said, you know, based on the probabilities, that was the right decision. It didn't work out on the day. So we've got to separate whether we call something a good decision or a bad decision. We've got to kind of disconnect that from the outcome a little sense. Like we're making the best decision.
It's good decisions that have bad outcomes and you can't help it. And you know, this happens in surgery. We do operations the same way every time and we get a variance in our results.
Yeah.
For 90% of people, it goes great. For 5% of people, it's tolerable. And for 5% of people, there's more work that needs to be done. But we did it all the same when we did it.
Yeah.
And we took into account all of those factors. And so having lived that experience, then it makes it easy then for me to transfer those concepts into business.
So let's make the jump into your plan B. So you've thought about, you know, this compressed work life as a maxillofacial surgeon. And obviously, you know, we hope and, you know, certainly as a selfish referring practitioner, I hope you stay there forever and a day.
So do I.
Yeah. But you have built a plan B. So can we just talk a little bit about what your plan B is and how you're operating that in conjunction with your plan A.
Yeah, sure. Well, to be fair, I have a B, a C, and a D, really.
Because
that's what we do in surgery as well. Like, again, you go in expecting to do one thing. If you encounter this problem, we're going to do this thing. If you encounter this problem, we're going to do this thing.
Yeah.
And that's just life. I mean, you know, you always have a checklist of where you're going to go. If this happens, I'm going to do this. If that works, I'll do this. I'll stop. If it doesn't work, then I'll go to this step. And so, for me, that's just kind of how I've done some of those things. So, you know, I do some teaching with Charles Sturt, which I really enjoy, and I do some medical administration work with the college. And then with my dear friend Sam Kim, we accidentally started the TMJ clinics about 7 years ago, and that has given me a lot of joy and a hell of a lot of learning in a very quick time.
I have to pick up on the word accidentally for a second, because how does one accidentally start the TMJ clinics?
Well, it's the truth. So Sam is a max fac surgeon, and he came down to Canberra to do a locum for us.
Yep.
And Sam had done his fellow. I did my fellowship in cancer. He did his in TMJ surgery.
Yep.
And a fellowship is that sort of optional year you do once you're qualified, just to kind of choose your niche.
Yep.
And he came to Canberra, and he told everyone that he did TMJ, and our practice was overrun with TMJ patients. Like, when I say overrun, I mean hundreds of TMJ patients.
Wow.
In the first month.
Wow.
And it was very clear to both Sam and myself, the surgery rate for TMJ is about 1%.
Yes.
And so he can't see 100 patients every week to do one operation. So the model of surgery in TMJ that had been in place for a long time was very much, you might see the worst TMJ patient as the surgeon, and you do your surgery on the worst one. But that didn't really make any sense either. You should do the surgery on the person who needs the surgery, not because they're the worst one you've seen that year or anything like that. And so, yeah, in our practice, we just had all of these people who needed to be looked after for their joints. And Sam had a real interest in it. I had an interest in TMJ, but when Sam came along, I just thought he was so good at it. I mean, he's an amazing TMJ surgeon. So it just made sense to kind of find a new solution for that. So it was just a problem that needed solving.
Isn't that really interesting? Because I actually think most businesses start in that way. You know, there's a problem. Who's going to solve it? Well, I guess I'd better solve it, and off you go. And I guess that's the accidental part of it, is there wasn't a solution out there already. So how many TMJ clinics did you accidentally start?
Eight now.
Well, one time is an accident. Eight times is just careless, mate. You know,
yeah, some of those were during COVID too. So, yeah. No, the first one was the accident, and then the second one was like the test case.
Yep.
Because we didn't really know if the first one was real or not, because it was in Canberra. It was kind of embedded within our surgical practice. We kind of thought maybe that's just like a byproduct of circumstances. So then we started one in Bankstown. But again, that was sort of embedded within Sam's Sydney practice. And so we're like, oh, I'm not sure about that. There was the third one in North Sydney was when we thought, actually, this is a real thing.
Mm.
You know, people will come here with this model, get looked after, not need surgery, go back to their dentist for their general dental treatment, and everyone will be happy and well looked after. And so that was, once we had that third one, then I think we realised that it almost felt like a responsibility to do more, because they work so well. You know, and some of them make money, some of them just sort of dawdle along a bit, and that's all fine. But in general, they just have a really unique spot in the landscape of dentistry at the moment in Australia, and it's a really lovely thing to be able to provide for people.
Yeah, it's a massively good service. I want to ask you, though, running eight practices, because that's quite a handful.
Yes.
What have you had to learn? Because, you know, my impression, and again, I'm not a specialist, and, you know, I don't want to assume, but my impression of, you know, a maxillofacial surgeon's life is you're consulting, you're in theatre, and it's often very focused in that kind of the person in front of you kind of phase, like in dentistry as well.
Yeah.
Obviously, you've got other surgeons that work in your practice, so you've got that practice to run. But that's a really different experience to running eight practices remotely, like, because not like you're running eight practices in Canberra where you can drive around and see them all very easily.
Yeah, it's hugely different. Yeah,
hugely different. So what have you had to learn to transition from running your specialty practice to running the TMJ clinics?
Pretty much everything. There were some skills that were transferable. I mean, we have an emphasis on culture, the same as we do in our surgery practice. And when I say culture, like, we don't do things for culture. We do things because it's kind, it's the right thing to do, and we care about the people that we work with.
Yeah.
And that is our culture. And, you know, it's part of our mission statement as a company to build smart and strong dentists and to look after the people that look after our patients. So that was transferable. The other thing that was transferable was delegation. So, you know, as you say, in surgery, I walk into theatre at 7:30 in the morning and I walk out at 12:30 and then I walk into the consulting office at 1:45 and I walk out again at 5:15 or 6:00. So in those two blocks, I am not available to help the practice manager or the staff solve their problems. And so, I mean, lucky I've only had two practice managers in 16 years. They're both fantastic people and very competent and able to work out what they need from me and when. And to do that, we have dedicated time. That made a really big difference for them. They know that, you know, it used to be a Tuesday, now it's a Friday morning. They will get my time where they can bring their list of things that they've accumulated during the week. If there's something really urgent during the week, then they'll break into that consulting time, or at lunchtime we'll have discussions. But in those blocks of work, focused work for me, they do their work and I do my work. And that was transferable then into remote clinics because I'm not there, Sam's not there. There's no one there who's going to solve that actual problem for you at the time. So we had to devise methods where people had access to us that was quarantined and safe for them. And that fitted really well with TMJ because TMJ has a multidisciplinary model. So we have a clinical meeting that Sam runs for all of the clinicians, you know, on a Wednesday night. They bring their patients to the meet, not their physical patients, but they bring the patient charts to the meeting and they'll go through the scans together. As a group, they'll discuss them, so there's group learning. And the clinicians know there's no need to ring Sam at 2:00 on a Tuesday afternoon. They just need to stay calm, reassure the patient, and, you know, they'll work it out over the next week or two at those meetings, come back to the patient with a solution. And it's the same with the staff. And I think that that is quite empowering for them because they go from being people who, you know, are at your door every 20 minutes saying, what should I do here, what should I do, to being people who are problem solvers and who can triage issues and make decisions about what's important and what's not. And so you get your staff really kind of become very strong, resilient people.
I wanted to pick up on something there because what struck me as you were describing your practice managers and how they have access to you at certain times of on a Friday, I guess, you know, following on from that is you need to give them authority to make certain decisions on your behalf as well, and not having to be the sole arbiter of everything that comes through the door, right? So where have you drawn the, I guess, the boundaries about this is a decision that the practice manager or a team member can make and this is a decision that needs to come to me because it's a big deal and I've got to kind of have the final sign off on it?
Probably the first thing I'd say about that is if you ask someone or make someone make a decision and you don't like the decision they made, you better be prepared just to sort of shut up and go with it.
Yeah.
And because you asked them to do it, you've trained them or you've given them the background.
Yep.
If you then criticize them for making that decision, you're just going to do untold damage to everyone. So that whole construct will fail almost immediately. So, you know, and no one is perfect. I make crappy decisions sometimes. You know, the people who I love and respect who help in these practices, sometimes they make decisions that they're probably not really happy with 3 months down the track. But like I was saying before, as long as everyone's taken all the information they have at hand, made their decision in good faith, if you're not happy with it 3 months down the track, we'll undo it and make a new decision. But in general, time solves so many problems. So
I agree. Yeah. And I think a lot of the decisions that we make now, I'm not including clinical decisions here just for clarity, but a lot
there is a difference. There is a big difference between clinical decision making and business decision making. And that's really important to know.
100%. Yeah. A lot of the business decisions we make are what I call two-way doors, right? You know, you can reverse the decision if you really need to. It might cost you a bit of time, might cost you a bit of money, but ultimately most of those decisions, if it really does turn out to be an absolute howler, you can kind of walk back and make it right again. Very rarely have I found, in a business sense at least, that those decisions are one-way doors where, like, once you go through it, you're through it and that's it.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you then, do you spend time with your team teaching them how you might think about certain things? Like, is that something like, let's get into the head of Dylan kind of routine? Like,
no, that would be an empty exercise. That'd be over very quickly.
No, but I guess what I'm trying to ask is, do you share, like, you know, this is how I would think about that? Or
we don't sit down and do a lesson, but when I make a decision, I explain why.
Yeah.
And so people learn just through time and through an exposure. So I'm sure it's the same for everyone in this situation. You're trying to be as repeatable and predictable and reliable as you can so that people can understand what's important to you and how you make your decisions, so that when they make their decisions, they know how you're going to assess their decision and what success is going to look like. And this is the same in everything. So this is the same in mentorship. This is the same in teaching. It's the same in life with family and kids. If you can have a strong construct of what matters to you and what are your non-negotiables, then the people around you have enormous security when they go to make their decisions or to behave a certain way or to react to a certain thing. You know, like, I can't remember the last time we had a crossword in our surgery practice, and we have lots of staff who come in and out of there. And I think that's because there are five, you know, surgeons there, none of whom tolerate treating people poorly. It's not just a me thing. That's, we have a, you know, no dickheads on the bus type policy for surgeons, for staff, for everybody. If you can't be kind to people, there are other practices for you to work at. And so it's very easy for people to understand that if something happens that's upset them, go and take a walk around the building, you know, go and buy a hamburger, go and do whatever it is that you're going to do. Collect your thoughts, collect your composure, and come back and deal with it of the way that kind of fits with us.
Yeah.
And that's really hard to impart remotely. So coming back to your original question, how do you do this remotely? You have to choose people who are going to represent your ethos all the way down the line. And that's really, that's been a challenge. We're in a sweet spot at the moment in the TMJ clinics where, you know, you look at the people who work for us and they're all fantastic people. Mm. And so I don't have any doubts that if one of them's challenged in a situation, that they're not going to act with sort of integrity and care towards the people around them.
Operating eight practices remotely is, yeah, it is challenging on some levels. Obviously, you guys do it really well. You're in your sweet spot. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about reporting, and you know, because you're in Canberra, you're running a busy, yeah, maxilla facial practice, you've got five surgeons in that practice, let alone all the other stuff happening around the TMJ clinics. From a business point of view, what sort of information are you looking to get back from those practices? How do you keep your finger on the pulse? Because it's like you can't look at everything. So what are the critical few things that you do look at to give you a sense of how things are going? And then if you need to dig deeper, obviously you can, but what's the headline stuff you're looking at?
So for us, because we're remote, because we're a lean team, we don't have a management office. We don't have a, we have an operations manager, and then we have clinic staff who kind of run the clinics. They're not practice managers though. So our operations manager knows everyone. And then there's Sam and myself. It's a very lean setup. So Sam takes the clinical decisions and they always take priority for us. Mm. The clinical stuff for us has to outweigh the business stuff. So we will often take a business decision where the numbers are not fantastic, but it means that clinically we will get a more reliable and repeatable outcome for people. And that can be a bitter pill to swallow when you're sitting there looking at a profit and loss sheet and, you know, thinking, oh, how are we going to make this work? And Sam says, well, actually, this scanner is better than this scanner. Can we replace these? Mm. And you think, oh, sure, mate. Yeah. So, but we do it.
Yeah.
We do it. And it really helps for us to have divided that. So Sam has the clinical focus and I have the business focus. And that makes a big difference because he has pretty much autonomy and he says what he needs and then we facilitate that. And then in terms of business, you know, because I'm busy, I'm going to take a high-level view of what's going on. It's my job to set the course for the bus, but not necessarily do the steering anymore.
So
we've got people who can do those sorts of things. They've learnt, they've been trained on how to do that. So when I look at metrics, the things that I'm looking at are outcomes always, you know, and Sam's looking at those. And then new patients is a really big thing for us. Conversion of new patients to treatment. We know, you know, we've had nearly 7,000 TMJ patients. We have the world's biggest database on TMJ. So we know that if you see 100 people, about two-thirds actually need treatment. Of one-third probably don't need treatment, or they need just to be reinforced what they've already been given by their dentist or those sorts of things. So we can have a look and say that over a period of time, not over a week or a month, but over an extended period of time, roughly, you know, two-thirds of our patients should be entering active treatment. And there's a percentage then for splints, for Botox, for physiotherapy, for dry needling, all of those sorts of things. So I tend to look at that and to see if any of our clinicians are having trouble, because our business model is built on young clinicians. And so they often need time to mature into how they communicate and how they, you know, reinforce to patients how big the problem is or how little the problem is. So we get to look at their performance, and then we just look at the basics of clinical performance. We don't get into how much we spend on gauze swabs. I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in how many new patients have come in, how much the phone's been answered, is our marketing working well, the patients that we have, are we looking after well, and then that's really about it. I don't get fussed about little stuff. It's just not an issue. It's really important where we're going, not so much how we're getting there, because we've sorted that before.
You spoke about Sam having the clinical lead, and you're always making your business decisions with a clinical decision first, basically. And you said sometimes it doesn't always make dollars and cents. I have a theory and a hypothesis. I actually think it makes really good business sense, because to do the right thing by the patient, for me, is never wrong. And I actually
agree.
And I think that it actually comes back to you in other ways, if that makes sense. It might not reflect in this month's, you know, P&L or even this financial year's P&L, but I actually think it is good business anyway, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it definitely is, Jesse. And it's a long-term play. And we're not here to flip anything. We're not trying to get something looking really sexy over the next 18 months and then flip it to private equity or do anything like that. We actually love this business. We're proud of it. It's a reflection of ourselves. So just like, you know, most of your listeners are probably general dentists, and I'm sure they have the same sense of pride in their practice and the experience that patients have when they come to see them.
Yeah.
Even though these are remote practices, they still reflect Sam and I. Our names are attached to these indelibly forever. Even if we get rid of the business in 30 or 40 years' time, you know, people will still remember that it was us who did that, and that reflects on us. And, you know, coming out of surgery where reputation is everything, and out of wanting to have a work and practice lifestyle where you can always be proud of what you've done, that transfers then into the TMJ practice of making decisions that are based around clinical success. And, you know, there's enough money in any – if there's not enough money for you to do it, to do the right thing, don't do it. Get into a different industry or a different practice.
100%. 100%. As I said, I just have this I think you've just nailed it. So it's taking the longer-term view and realizing that all comes back to you in, you know, good ways down the track. I wanted to ask you a little bit about remote operating. I run our whole team, I'm not sure if you're aware, but our whole team is remote as well. I'm the only one based in Canberra, and we have team, you know, all over the place. And it's tremendous, because you do get the opportunity to tap into talent that might not be locally based, et cetera, et cetera. And communication can be challenging sometimes too, because we deal a lot with you know, what's referred to as asynchronous communication, you know, whether using Slack or Teams or whatever it is. How do you manage to keep those communication channels really flowing well? I know you've got the dedicated time here and there, but do you use technology in terms of those sorts of platforms as well? What's that look like for
within
you?
Within the practices, they're really big on Teams, Microsoft Teams.
Yeah.
you know, they and we run a virtual call centre.
Yep.
We run virtual telehealth. So you might be in Brisbane having your telehealth, but the lady's looking after you and the clinician's seeing you. The ladies are in Canberra and the clinician is in Sydney or Orange or wherever the clinician happens to be. So we're really big on technology. It's part of our mission statement, again, is to run a smart and profitable business that utilises technology well. You know, that we've always had a focus on that. We were a digital practice from day one. Mm. You know, it was painful. It was painful to be a digital practice in 2017.
Yes.
It's less painful now. It still has days of pain. But, you know, we committed to that. And again, it's a long-term strategy. And now we are ahead of the curve in terms of managing digital workflows. So we do that both clinically and in terms of business. The main thing for us, though, is having quarantine pathways and times for communication. So the operations manager, she has a rolling roster of visiting clinics. She has time set aside for each clinic, and then she has time set aside for a group meeting with the clinic. So she, and that flows off from Sam and I having dedicated time for her. So yeah, that kind of filters down through everybody.
Yeah, I really, really love that. That whole cadence, that rhythm that you've got going there is really critical. I think people then can feel like, okay, I might not have spoken to someone today, but I know that next week the ops manager is coming through and I've got opportunity to speak there. I think the issues arise when people feel like there's nothing coming down the pipeline for them to raise their concerns, or there's no avenue for this or that. So I really love the way you've structured that.
It all comes back to discipline too. I mean, there are days when I don't want to do the meeting.
Of course.
You know, I'm sure there's days where operations manager Christina, she doesn't want to talk to whoever it is, or what's on the agenda, or what you know you're going to have to talk about is painful or uncomfortable. But you just have to take your medicine. I mean, if you want to play in the game, there are sometimes you have to take the hit. Sometimes you have to take the hit so your team member can get a hit or do whatever it is, and that's just part of life. And so, again, if you don't think that, you know, you're built to be, you know, able to do some of that boring discipline stuff, maybe a smaller practice where you can have a more ad hoc communication style is going to fit you much better.
So we talk about the transition from small practice to large practices, like going from being a band of pirates to being an organised Navy.
Yes.
Because when...
Nice analogy.
Yeah, well, I know it's close to my heart, obviously, mate. I don't know what the Army equivalent is. Sorry, mate.
No idea.
But anyway, but you're absolutely right. In a small practice, you can have those corridor conversations. You can have the, oh, by the way, or the whatever. But when you are operating eight practices like you are, you don't have that luxury. It has to become disciplined. It has to become formalized. It has to become structured. And I think you're absolutely right. I think if you're going to have any success in scaling your business, which you guys have, there has to be that discipline and that cadence to it. Otherwise, it just becomes chaos. And one of the things I'm fond of saying is I think mess scales faster than anything else.
Yep, 100%. Yeah.
I don't know if you've experienced. I've certainly experienced that.
It's like mold. It just takes over everything, right?
And it's really hard to unscramble it once it becomes messy, right? It's hard to bring order to it.
And that was something we really struggled with, Jesse. I mean, I sit here and I say this now, but, you know, the first couple of years for us, we didn't know what we were doing. You know, when I think of the lovely people who came and worked for us and how we really tried hard but didn't know what we were doing and how tolerant of us they were, I look back and I just kind of feel a bit embarrassed that we didn't do a better job. But part of that was because we didn't really believe in ourselves at that stage. We didn't necessarily believe in the concept. We didn't think that we were qualified to run a business. We didn't think that we had the skill set that was needed. We didn't think we could find the people because we were busy clinicians in, you know, Canberra and Sydney. We were like, what do we know about hiring operations managers or those sorts of things, or media people, whatever. And that was reflected then. So it took us some time to build the self-confidence that you can then project forward onto the next layer of people so that they can be confident. It's been an evolution and an organic bit of growth for us. We did not wake up knowing how to do this.
Yeah.
We learned.
Oh, I don't think anyone wakes up with that knowledge, mate. It's certainly not part of the DNA. I think it is learned through bitter experience sometimes, to be honest, through hard experience, right?
Yeah.
Mate, you've been really, really kind and generous with your time today. I want to firstly say thank you for that. I have one last question that I'd really, maybe two last questions, but the first question is, as a leader, how has Dylan changed over the course of, you know, launching these accidental TMJ clinics?
as a leader, I've changed probably in the same way I have as a person, in which I'm kinder to the people around me and I'm kinder to myself.
Mm.
And that's probably age and a collection of 1,000 scars. You know, so it's the same in theatre. I think everyone who knows me knows some people are surprised that I'm this vaguely mellow person, but actually I get more done when I'm mellow than when I'm angry. And it just took me a really long time to be confident in myself to know that I could still achieve things if I was kind as opposed to if I was strict. You know, I don't think I was ever unkind, but I think I was probably very strict with myself and with the people around me. And I don't think I need to be that strict now, because I think actually people want to do a really good job. They want to be proud of what they do, and it's more my job to give them the environment to succeed in rather than to force them to conform to whatever is going on at the time. So that's probably the biggest change in that.
Mate, actually, I'm probably opening up a whole conversational thread here, but what the heck. But I have a perspective, and that is I haven't ever met a person who comes to work wanting to do a bad job, ever. Not once.
No.
And I feel like sometimes when the practice owner might be viewing someone's performance in an unfavourable way, oftentimes there's been a breakdown in communication about what's expected of the role, what success looks like, et cetera, et cetera. So I agree with you. I think our role as the business owner is to clearly define what a successful outcome looks like and to provide the environment and the resources for that person to be able to achieve it.
And there are people who at times just can't in your environment. They can't fit into your practice. They can't do the work. There's too much going on at home. There's too much going on in life. They never had the skill set to begin with. You chose the wrong person, whatever it is. And actually, you know, we've had people who we've tried to get into that sort of successful position, and it's become clear that they can't. And then when we sat down and had a conversation and said, it's not working out, you don't fit here, the look of relief for them has been insane. Like,
yeah.
I kind of think, you know, so now I really feel like it's okay to get people to move or to move on or to change roles or change workplace or whatever it is, because everybody wants to do well. Nobody likes coming to work and feeling bad about what they're doing. I think, you know, when you talked about how we've grown as a business and people, we're probably better at doing that for people now, so that if it's not working, we try and find out what will work, and if that's not working, we try and encourage them to find somewhere for themselves that will.
Yeah.
And that might, you know, people might think, oh, that's a euphemism for giving someone the sack, but it's actually not. We don't really sack anyone ever. We're really continually trying to find places for people or environments for people where they're going to be happy. And when they're happy, they succeed.
Yeah. I use the word we'd like to liberate people. And sometimes, again, I often say it with a bit of a smile, and it can be interpreted as a euphemism for sacking people, but I actually really believe that it is liberating them and liberating us at the same time.
Once you've had to sack people, you appreciate that it is different.
Sacking people is the worst job in the world. I mean,
awful.
It is absolutely awful. I've done it a handful of times, and I hope I never do it again. It's something that I break out into a sweat over.
Yeah, hands down, the worst part of owning a business.
Yeah, without a doubt. Without a doubt. Hey, Dylan, I did say I had one last question in the bank ready to go, and I'm curious to ask because we've spoken a little bit about your early days, you know, getting into dentistry, not going down the engineering path, obviously going down to the specialty training, owning the specialty practice, and then, of course, going into the TMJ practices. What's the future hold for you, mate?
Oh, Jesse, I don't know. I actually really love what I do. Like, as I said at the beginning, I feel very lucky to be in this position. Obviously, you know, as you know, I've had 2 heart surgeries now. I don't expect to be able to work until I'm 80. I think that's not a realistic thing for me. So, but I do enjoy working. I do enjoy that social contact. I do enjoy project work and doing things that I think are vital and of importance to me or other people. So I dare say what will happen for me over the next 10 to 15 years, hopefully, is I do less clinical work, but that'll be a slow phase out. Everyone who refers, I'm not retiring. you know, I might drop a day of clinic and do more business or teaching or admin or whatever tickles my fancy at the time, to be honest. And that changes from time to time, every 5 or 10 years something else comes along that seems really interesting and exciting.
Yeah, amazing. Mate, well, as much as you say you've had a lucky life, I feel really lucky that we've had the opportunity to talk to you today, mate. So thank you for taking the time out of your day to come and hang with us. I feel like I could probably talk for another couple of days and just keep going, but I'm mindful of the time and I'm really grateful that you've spent so much of it with us today, mate. So thank you, Dylan, for sharing your experiences, sharing your insights and sharing so freely and generously, mate. I'm really touched. Thank you.
Oh, it's an absolute delight, Jesse. You're so good at this. And I tell you what, I don't know of any other podcast. How many podcasts have you done?
I've lost count. We're over 450. I think we're getting close to 460 or something like that now.
That must be like a record. I mean, how many people get even past 3? Yeah. Let alone 450. So congratulations. It's a really massive achievement.
Thank you, mate. I appreciate that. It's really kind of you. You're a good man. Thank you, pal. All right, we'll catch up soon, mate.
Cheers. See you.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast. For more episodes, go to drjessegreen.com/savvydentist. And to discover how to build a high-performance dental practice, visit drjessegreen.com and download the free report.